Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Last week, we promised you six films, including one that was going to split us apart, split us in two, and we would be shouting at each other. Well, we're going to give you four. One of them was pushed back a week, which is the one we were going to scream at each other about. And we just didn't go to one.
For good reason.
I was tired, and I did a double feature the day before.
It was cold.
It was cold. There was a moon of some sort.
It looked violent. I just, I couldn't do it.
I was tired. Yeah, yeah.
But which movie was that we skipped?
We skipped Den of Thieves.
Den of Thieves, which did have Gerard Butler, which almost got me to go.
Geostorm had Gerard Butler. We didn't see that either.
I know. Sorry, Gerard.
All right. This wine is an oldie but not goodie. We've had this like three times.
It is Dark Horse, original Dark Horse.
I don't think we've had the Merlot yet. It comes in Pinot Noir, Cab Sav, Chardonnay, and Merlot. I don't think we've done the Merlot
yet. And I somehow suspected that you would pick a horse-related wine because...
What are we starting with?
We are starting with 12 Strong, which is about the horse soldiers that went into Afghanistan shortly after 9/11.
This was a story nobody, well, in the regular civilian world knew about because it was classified. The first weeks after 9/11, the first men into Afghanistan after the first CIA dude paying off warlords was Green Berets. Army Green Berets, led by Chris Hemsworth, went into Afghanistan.
A good old Aussie.
To take over Mazar-e-Sharif. And it was one ODA, one Operational Detachment Alpha, but they're better known as Task Force Dagger. Went in, and in 2 or 3 weeks, mopped up a whole bunch of Taliban and Al-Qaeda with the help of some B-52s and hanging out with a warlord and learning about the foreign ways of not only Muslim culture, but Afghan culture, which perplexed them. These are highly trained, skilled soldiers. It's an action film. It's kind of, at some points, a deeper philosophical film about what it means to be a leader and a soldier. Hannah, I got a kick out of this. I really had a good time.
I figured you would, that you did. I mean, to me, it was just a middle-of-the-road war movie. It was a war movie. I loved it. I don't know. I was torn. I actually think Chris Hemsworth, as much as I love him, he is an Australian actor playing somebody with a Kentucky accent, I think, was what he was going
for.
Was
it Kentucky?
And I actually sensed throughout this film that he was straining to have this American voice. And so I was really surprised to read that, I mean, they really went after him for this role. And as the captain of this Special Forces team. And they even cast his real-life wife.
They did. That's Elsa Pataky.
As his wife in this film, just so that they could be together for
and
a couple of weeks.
She got to keep her
filming.
Spanish from Spain, formal
yeah.
Spanish accent.
Yeah, so that was just a little weird to me. That part kind of bothered me. You had this really good supporting cast with Michael Pena, who I then sat there going, wasn't he in another 9/11 movie? And it took me a while, and it was like, it was that World Trade Center movie, and he played this transit cop that was buried in the rubble. And so here he is playing this...
Sergeant First Class Diller.
Yeah, so and then there's Michael Shannon, who I also love, who we recently saw in Shape of Water, and he didn't really have much to do.
Well, he was the old, grizzled, I'm supposed to be retired by now veteran.
Yeah.
He's the guy who, you know, they rode horses, you know, to cross these mountains. They couldn't, you know, helicopters were out of the question. They didn't have armored personnel carriers. They had horses, and he's the old dude who's never ridden a horse, so of course he slips a disc.
Yeah, it's always fascinating when these stories get declassified and suddenly you get to hear about them, and it was quite a victory in the early part of this war. I did appreciate the fact that, you know, they've really you understand that all the civil war that real the factions that are in Afghanistan that make it so difficult to to battle the Taliban because you have to get the warlords to battle a common enemy. And that's, you know, kind of part of the focus here is that can the U.S. troops get these warring factions in Afghanistan to unite to battle the Taliban? And I actually thought about that movie that you like, The Breadwinner.
Oh, yeah.
Because there is a moment where you're seeing how the Taliban are really brutal against girls and women in education.
Kind of a superfluous scene. Yeah. Because they're reminding you, here's what, you know, yes, the Taliban sheltered Al-Qaeda who attacked the Twin Towers. But here's this quick scene of them shooting a school teacher in the head because you don't educate females. And it's kind of just encapsulated to remind you the Taliban are bad people.
Yeah. And I would just say that if you kind of want to learn more about that than the Breadwinner animated movie, that's really
a lot better.
That was a story within.
On that part.
On that slight part of it. Because everything else really is this heroic, you know, rah-rah, you want these 12 team members to all survive, and Chris Hemsworth, as the captain, is saying, you know, I am going to bring 100% of my team home.
Well, there's these spaces that, like, it is raw. It's a lot of action, a lot of shooting and horseback riding and shooting off of horses and explosions and bombs and danger close. Air-to-ground munitions, but there's these spaces in between where Captain Nelson, who you're talking about, is getting buddy-buddy and establishing rapport and camaraderie with Warlord Dostum, who we'll get to in a second, by the way. And that's where the script, it doesn't get clunky, but it fits it in. It squeezes in Afghan history on the fly. Dostum gets these, this is the graveyard of empires.
That's right.
And you don't understand your enemy. They do not fear death like you fear death. You're doing them a favor. They're going to their 72 virgins. Their life is horrible here. They want to die, and that's how fierce they're going to attack you. Then Captain Nelson, he's the main character, and he gets to play all the roles. He is lead soldier number one. He's the forward air controller. He's the diplomat.
He's the diplomat, absolutely.
You know, Dostum doesn't just hate the Taliban. He also hates his fellow warlords. He's a philosopher. And he's like, well, let me tell you, you know, because they're testing each other, and he has to come up with these metaphors. He's a metaphor guy. So, and it's directed by a guy I've never heard of before, Nikolai Fugelsieg. And yes, this is his first, you know, foray out into the wider world. And he did a good job. This movie almost functions as a Western in some capacity.
It feels a lot like a Western. But what's interesting is that the director, who I let you say the name of because I still can't figure out how exactly to say his name, it is being promoted and marketed as a Jerry Bruckheimer film. And so Jerry Bruckheimer is a producer on this movie.
Yeah.
And Jerry Bruckheimer did Black Hawk Down, Top Gun.
Gone in 60 seconds.
And so, without a doubt, Jerry Bruckheimer might not have directed this movie, but I suspect he influenced the directing of this movie by this unknown.
So he got a director he could shape and mold?
I believe that had to be the case, because otherwise I can't even imagine how this particular director landed this big movie. So I liked it, but to me it's middle. It falls in the middle of just a solid, good war movie, much along the lines of any of those, like Peter Berg's Lone Survivor, kind of had a little bit of that vibe going.
Yeah. I liked Lone Survivor a little. In fact, Lone Survivor made my top 10 list out here.
Yeah,
so I liked it a bit better than this.
Right.
And at the end, they have those postscripts. This is the significance of what they did. And, you know, they didn't come home to fanfare and blah, blah, blah. And it has a little blurb on Dostum. It's like they left a lot out about that. He actually comes off as a very good ally. And, technically, he is currently Afghanistan's first vice president, but he's also been kicked out of his own country and is in exile because he sodomized one of his political opponents with a broom handle.
Well, you know, other than that.
But other than that, enjoy the movie, folks.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a feel-good movie, but
it's a feel-good broom handle.
In a certain sense, it's also kind of sad because it reminds you that they won. And they say, I think even in the movie, you know, it's like, we won this battle, but the war went on for, it's still going on.
It's still going on.
So we're talking, you know,
17 years later.
17 years later, and this battle that they fought and won in the month after 9/11 actually has not resolved itself, you know, this war. And that's sad.
Dostum was foreshadowing when, you know, after this, if you leave, you'll be considered cowards. But if you stay, we're going to hate you.
Well, we're between a rock and a hard place, and that kind of sucks. But so if you like a good war drama, you know, and it's Thor.
It is, though. I know. I think I'm standing behind this film. I think it's a very good movie.
It's solid. It's solid.
All right, our next film wanted to be solid. It wanted to be an Oscar picture, and it set itself up as that, and it went to the film festivals, and it played the game, and it has really strong leading roles. And everyone saw it, and was like, wow, that's not very good. And that's why you haven't heard too much of this movie. It hasn't been nominated for anything.
But it might not have been nominated. It might not have cracked the Oscar nomination.
It thought it would. This is a movie you watch, and like, I think I'm going to be nominated for Oscars.
I agree, but there's a big difference between it didn't get nominated for an Oscar, and it's not a very good movie.
No, I'm telling you, I'm getting into why Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool is not a very good film at all. Even though it is based on a memoir. It's based on a true story, based on a memoir by one Peter Turner. Had you ever heard of the actress Gloria Graham before this?
I did not recognize the name, but when somebody started telling me, oh, she played Violet in It's a Wonderful Life, I'm like, oh, okay.
So I have seen some films that Gloria Graham was in with Humphrey Bogart in A Lonely Place. I saw Oklahoma. Apparently she was in Oklahoma.
Yes, I think she was the girl who just can't say no, maybe.
But I had no idea who Gloria Graham was.
Yeah,
and she
I
won
agree.
An Oscar in 1952.
Yeah.
But this is not
a best supporting actress.
This is not a biopic. This is not taking place in the 50s. This is not prime. And she was like a femme fatale. She was what you call the vixen, the bad girl.
In the
film
noir.
And apparently she talked like a Marilyn Monroe, I suppose.
She did. She had a very
whispery
raspy
voice.
Yeah.
But no, this takes place in 79 when Gloria Graham's 57 and she gets a boyfriend who's far her 30 years her junior,
he's like
Jamie
in his
Bell.
20s.
Annette
yeah,
Bening
20s.
Gets to hang out in the Au Naturel with Jamie Bell.
Oh, come
and
on.
That's fine. I have no problem with May-December relationships, especially if it's true. This is based on Peter Turner, who was the guy. Peter Turner was the guy who got with Gloria Graham, wrote a memoir about it. And then director Paul McGuigan, adapted it. And I think it fell flat. Kerplunk on the floor.
You're missing a big part of it. This movie was, it's more, I think, for the chicks. It just is. Or for a lot of...
Well, you gotta separate everything about gender.
No, but it's not gender, but I don't think it's bad. I actually found it, what made it appealing to me, and this is, I saw it so long ago at Middleburg, but in the midst of Middleburg, I remember thinking it was good. Did I think it was going to break through? No.
They did.
But they might have, but that's not... You know, that's neither here nor there. We know better. but it's part drama, part romance, part biopic. So there were elements of it. It's not just about, it's not a story just about their relationship, their May-December relationship. It's really about what was going on between them after she's diagnosed with cancer. And so it's like they start this relationship. She ends up getting diagnosed with cancer. And they had broken up, and then they kind of, she ends up gravitating back towards Turner and his family in her final days. And that's a big part of the story. And so you're sort of glossing over what the heart of
No, well, the better part of the
movie.
Story is their present day, their like 1980, 81 version of present day in Liverpool, where mom and dad, and mom's played by Julie Walters, are, you know, have opened their home to this dying woman, this famous dying woman. And that is the better part of the film. But that's, I don't know, 40% of the film. 60% of the film, they're fighting with each other.
No,
and she's
not.
Like, how dare you call me old? I can play Juliet.
I think you fixated on the wrong parts of the movie and therefore didn't appreciate the big picture. And I do believe that the fact that most people, Gloria Graham, is just simply not a name of recognition that jumps out at them And I don't know if Annette Bening is enough.
But I'm not ragging on people. It that it's not a famous person that didn't remain famous. That's not why I didn't like the film. I didn't like the couple. I didn't think they worked. And she, skipped over about her that they really could have gone into.
Well, I was going to say that one of the interesting things about seeing a film at Middleburg at a film festival and you're chatting with people between movies and you're hearing about why people have seen certain things and have skipped others. And there was somebody I talked to who purposely skipped this movie because she felt that they were skipping over and glossing over the fact that she did have this. She had had an affair with her husband's son and ended up marrying her stepson.
And that's a glossy way to say that she was caught in bed with a 13-year-old.
So there was definitely, they left that out.
That was, I mean, Vanessa Redgrave alluded to it.
It's alluded to. And so there are anyone who absolutely already truly does know Gloria Graham's history may not be okay with the narrow view. But again, this is based on Turner's memoir of their relationship.
And he didn't know her at that point.
And it is based on what happened between really 1979 and I think she died in 1981.
Yeah.
And so if you look at it that way, that it's just this window into Gloria Graham and into their relationship and into her, what was going on in her head and the choices that she made because of the cancer diagnosis, then that's what this movie is. It's that portion of time. But if you go back and you read more about her because you're trying to figure out what do I know her from, what might I have seen her in, you're like, oh, that's kind of icky.
Now, you've seen her, but you don't know you've seen her. And the director, you've probably seen his films, but you don't know you've seen his films. Paul McGuigan actually had a run of mid-grade films in the mid-2000s. He did Lucky Number 11 and Wicker Park, so he had like a Josh Hartnett fixation. Wicker Park was actually a very good film. And in 2015, he did a film nobody saw called Victor Frankenstein. That was James McAvoy and Daniel Radcliffe, by the way. But, this one just left me flat out cold.
I think you just missed the whole point, and I don't see many other...
I saw the point. He made a romance.
We don't have any other melodramas or even to choose from, so at least it's got really good acting.
Just because it's a melodrama, it's the only melodrama we have right now, just make it good.
It's a good melodrama, and so if somebody, it's not fair when everything is just these, like, Den of Thieves or Shoot 'Em Up, and you've got your war movie with 12 Strong. Sometimes people are looking for just a good old-fashioned melodrama.
No, if you want good old-fashioned, go see Paddington 2. And not enough of you did, and I'm yelling at you, audience. You didn't go see Paddington 2.
And it's got the best Rotten Tomatoes score, ever.
All time.
100%. And I saw somebody last night who remarked about that and had not seen the movie and still was not planning to see the movie. And I remember telling them, seriously, it's good.
It's got 100% for a reason.
It's really
because
sweet.
Because of Knuckles McGinty.
I don't think it was Knuckles. But so anyway, I do disagree with you on Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, because while it's not great, but it's certainly not good.
It's not good.
It's good.
It's a cold fish. As opposed to our next film, which is takes place kind of on a hot stove. Hannah, do you remember being a carefree teenager?
It was so long ago, Charlie.
No problems in the world. There you are, screeching your Pontiac Trans Am wheels and donuts in the high school parking lot with your significant other on your lap.
Wasn't that Lady Bird? Didn't we just see that in Lady Bird?
Well, Nicolas Cage and Selma Blair, they remember their carefree teenage days because now they are workaday stiffs with two kids who could care less about them. And they are just, it's not necessarily midlife crisis, but they're depressed. They're a sneeze away from someone mentioning the word divorce. They have one of those McMansions in the suburbs. They have jobs they hate. Well, at least Nicolas Cage does. She spends her days doing yoga or whatever. But something happens, and we don't know what it is, but something happens, and call it a zombie film if you will, but parents start getting infected somehow.
I think you failed to even tell people what the name of this
movie is. We're talking about Mom and Dad, obviously. I'm talking about Mom and Dad. And all the mom and dads, across the world, all the mom and dads are all of a sudden just sick of their kids. And that's a kind way of putting it, sick of their kids. They become second-degree murdering sick. They won't kill anybody else's kids. They're fine with them. They won't kill their neighbors. They won't kill adults if you're over 18 or whatever. But if your child is within visual range, you will pick up the nearest butcher knife, axe, or shotgun and murder your child. And it's an hour. It's a full 2 hours and change.
It is.
Of parents saying, you know what, son, I've had it with you, and I'm going to kill you.
And this movie is
phenomenal. This movie is so phenomenal.
I am going to hide your toddler, Charlie.
It's so good.
Oh, my goodness.
Do you remember the message I sent you after I watched
this? You did. It was, you must watch this movie, I believe was the message you sent. And, of course, I then decided, sure, fine, I will. Nicolas Cage, you know, you're like, it's a weird, it's like a B movie. It's like one
it
of those
B-movie.
B horror movies.
Because it's only in one theater in your town.
But you can catch it on video
on
demand.
It's already on video on demand. So you can see this right now as I'm raving about this fantastic movie.
I considered it, it's like a B movie with star power, which is unusual. And the kids are good too. So you've got the focus of this particular story, even though these parents are on a murderous rampage around the world and in this suburban town, the story focuses on this particular family and these two kids trying to save themselves from their parents, even though, you know, everything started out hunky-dory in the morning. Yeah. And it even opens, the film opens. I do remember it was hysterical because you don't know what you're getting into. It opens like one of these Hallmark dramas, Hallmark, just a sweet movie that it's like got the music playing and you're seeing these wide shots of the cul-de-sacs and people mowing their lawns. I remember it had just a really, just one of those traditional theme music, you know, theme songs going with the opening credits. And suddenly, when you talk about a movie taking a turn, this movie definitely takes a turn.
Well, and it explores its theme and what it's talking about. Of course, 50-year-old tired parents want to murder their teenagers. I get it, and I don't even have a teenager. But what if you're a brand new mom in the maternity ward? There's a scene set there set to Roxette's It Must Have Been Love, and you'll never, ever hear that song the same way again. And what if you're grandparents and then you see your middle-aged 50-year-old son? What happens then? Yeah. And we find out.
It's a good little twist. That was a fun little moment. And it does the sort of tagline for this movie was, your parents brought you into this world and they most certainly can take you out of it. Even if they have to hunt you down first.
My favorite blurb I saw, and it fits, it's so perfect, is Home Alone on bath salts. Because they are running around this house, tearing it apart, kind of like they did in Home Alone when the robbers and Macaulay Culkin. Yeah, Home Alone on bath salts. And all right, so this is written and directed by Brian Taylor. We've seen him from Gamer and both Cranks, Crank and Crank High Voltage.
Gee, I think I missed both of those.
I love the Crank films, by the way. And he also did Ghost Rider 2, so he's got a Nicolas Cage thing going on. This is destined to become a midnight movie cult classic thing.
Well, the Variety reviewer agrees with you because I did jot down that the Variety reviewer described it as a, quote, giddy experience, and I already see the giddiness in you, that transcends mere bad taste humor to become one of the great jet black comedies about suburbia, destined for the same cult classic status, as you just said, accorded to The Stepford Wives, Parents, and Heathers.
Stepford Wives is not a cult classic. Now, Heathers, okay, I can see that.
But I'm not sure. I'm just not sure. I don't know.
Nicolas Cage takes up a sledgehammer, beats the hell out of a pool table, all while screaming the hokey pokey.
I just don't know if enough people will grasp what this movie is supposed to be.
And it's funny. It's yes, they're chasing their kids down with baseball bats, and not all the kids in the neighborhood get away. And it's hysterical.
It's a zombie type of movie. It's dark comedy, satire, horror kind of thing. And then the kids are decent. Ann Winters, who is from 13 Reasons Why on TV, and this kid Zachary Arthur, who was in the Fifth Wave.
Yeah, it's like I know I've seen that kid somewhere.
Yeah, so
that
movie stank. I think he was the younger brother.
Yeah,
or something.
He was the younger brother.
But the boyfriend of the teenage girl in this film is played by a guy named Robert Cunningham, who I just discovered last week is a recent graduate of Northwestern University and lived in the same dorm that I did.
Your alma mater.
Not only just my school alma mater, but my actual dorm
alma
mater.
That's weird. You guys have like a dorm thing, a listserv.
We do. We have a Facebook page. And so they posted to alert us that the CRC-er was in this movie and that they are going to have a special screening February 9th at Northwestern.
Look at that. Take
it
off.
At the university. But can you imagine? I just would love to be a fly on the wall when people actually see it, because I don't know if you remember, but that boyfriend survives.
There's a Get Out vibe there.
There's a total Get Out vibe. There's a Get Out vibe, but there's also this can anything kill certain people in this movie?
Well, he gets a bump on the head. You know.
Didn't he have a hanger through his face or something? So I don't
know. A hanger won't kill you.
I don't know.
It's a wire.
I don't know. It gets kind of gruesome.
Well, it's not. It is a midnight movie.
Yeah.
Those are gruesome.
So, I thought it was different. I certainly give you that. But how you can pan somebody potentially going to see a Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool when they want to just see a melodrama.
I'm not anyone.
And you're trying, you think that the better movie.
I'm not sending 70-year-old women to go see Mom and Dad.
No, but you think that the better movie is the...
I don't think that. I know the better movie is Mom and Dad.
The one that, we love you, but...
It's just...
But we don't.
No, it's
sometimes we love you, but sometimes you really... I could kill you.
Yes, and it's a genre experiment that works. He had this idea, he jotted it down on paper, got some money together, found Nicolas Cage somewhere, and it works.
It does as a B movie.
Who cannot identify with this movie? People get up every day, go to a miserable job, probably have miserable kids, and they would never do it. But there's that one part in their soul where they've thought about it.
All right.
It's just a fascinating, and I'll leave it with experiment.
Okay, experiment is a good word.
All right, our final film is a documentary, and it might be the most depressing thing I've ever seen in my life.
At least the past year.
And the director didn't intend to make this movie. This current events in the real world made this movie what it is. The director, Greg Barker, he had an idea. He's like, you know what? The Obama administration is on its way out. This is their last year. This is 2016. And I'm interested in foreign policy, so I'm going to follow Ben Rhodes, I'm going to follow Samantha Power, John Kerry, and a little bit of Barack Obama, what I can get access. And he's just going to follow what they're doing in their last year. As we have a little bit of time left, so we want to do Cuba, we want to do Iran, there's Syria, what are we going to do with Syria?
It's the foreign affairs team, the national security team.
And it was just going to be this throwaway, okay, maybe academics will be interested documentary. And then something happened. Donald Trump accidentally won a presidential election, and this movie, he didn't intend to make it this way, looks so different.
It does.
It's so, and I just,
I wanted to cry.
It hurt to watch it.
It did.
We're watching adults in the room, and they're castigating Russia. It's like, have you no shame? People are dying in Syria for chemical weapons, and you're letting that happen. And they're trying to save the world of nuclear weapons from Iran, and they're opening business with Cuba, and they can speak intelligently. They don't own side businesses, and they don't tweet all the time. And they're adult. And you wouldn't, if Hillary Clinton won the election, this would be the most boring thing I've ever seen in my life.
Right.
And then they're so mature.
They're smart and they're passionate and they're knowledgeable. And, oh, it was just, I wanted to cry.
That you spend the whole time, and he didn't mean it this way, but you spend the whole time comparing.
Well, because what this initial behind the scenes thing was supposed to show, and it's kind of cool. It has sort of a West Wing vibe. Mm. Or if you watch Madam Secretary now, it really reminded me a lot of Madam Secretary with the amount of time that they focus on UN Ambassador Samantha Power. And so she reminded me a lot of that same character. But it was really about these foreign policy experts trying to solidify Obama's legacy, like making sure that these signature pieces of legislation and these deals that were hammered out on the global stage were preserved. And we have seen, and to see this, and to see the hard work that they put into the Paris Climate Agreement and into, going to Nigeria and Boko Haram and the fight against Boko Haram. And just, it was, oh my gosh, you just realized how far we've dropped on in terms of the influence and the respect that you had on the global stage. And I think that's what that was the real crime here. Is it's not a great documentary. Like, I would have been incredibly bored 2 years ago if I had seen this in process. But seeing it now is just powerful and palpable and depressing. And unfortunately, absolutely nobody will see this movie who doesn't already get that. And who is not, who isn't nostalgic for the Obama administration.
I wanted to curl up into a ball and cry myself to sleep after this was over. There's a moment, Ben Rhodes had a mini scandal halfway through. Mm-hmm. He said some things about the media, about how he sold the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, with Iran, how he sold it to the media, how they didn't quite understand the whole thing. That was his major scandal. And now you have a president calling those same media people traitors, and how we should throw these mainstream media fake news people in jail. And it's like, that was Ben Rhodes' scandal, and now you have, like, the clown car on fire?
Yeah, and he was like a national security advisor. And so this really was – even though Obama appears in this film, there was just a couple of scenes peppered throughout. There was obviously just a quick interview that the director got in the hallway, But so that sort of bookends this film. But the real focus is on this national security team. And it's but when they do go in and out of the Obama stuff, it's just about you miss the combination of humor and compassion and intellect that signified what was going on the world stage. And right now, that is just kind of all, you just see it all disappearing.
Well, they show Obama commanding rooms in Laos, in Greece, and they show Samantha Power in Niger, cradling dying people, and South Sudan going, you know, what is going on with the world? And now we've got a guy who can't even go to London.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely, and I've seen that word over and over and over again with other folks who have reviewed this documentary, and everyone just uses the word depressing.
It is.
And it is depressing.
If you're already sad, do not watch this movie.
I mean, it's 89 minutes, and those 89 minutes don't exactly fly, but for the retrospective of what, it's so sad that it feels like we're longing for this bygone era that was 2016.
And it wasn't that long. God, it feels so long ago.
2016.
And, you know, it shows him on election night. Samantha Power had this room full of very powerful women. Madeleine Albright showed up, and Ben Rhodes ends up, like, crying in the parking lot.
Yeah. And just, but that also was one of the coolest parts of this documentary, though, was it humanized these people behind the scenes. And how I kept thinking, man, if I saw Ben Rhodes on the metro to D.C. with his backpack and stuff.
Give him a hug.
I wouldn't recognize him. Like, I wouldn't know who that was. And so they weren't about necessarily glorifying their own existence.
You know who pretty much took Ben Rhodes' place is Jared Kushner.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my God. And so all of a sudden it just puts things into a very different perspective.
It's fascinating in all the wrong ways.
Yep.
All right, recap here. We kicked off with the week's biggest release, which was 12 Strong, and man, I gotta kick it. And maybe I'm biased. I spent a long time in Afghanistan, and it's just a great war western. Wow, I'm glad the story finally got publicized. Movie.
I love a good you know, declassified story that gets turned into a good movie. I think Argo kind of set a very high bar for that sort of thing. And this doesn't reach those heights. But hey, if it's got Chris Hemsworth in it, even with a very bizarre Kentucky accent, then I'm more inclined to watch. Michael Peña, Michael Shannon. I mean, I enjoyed the performances for the most part, but to me, still in the end, it's a pretty middle-of-the-road war movie.
Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool is also a declassified story about
story.
A May December romance, and it's a wet mop lying on the floor in a puddle.
It is not the greatest biopic romance you'll ever see, but I totally disagree that I don't think it's great, but it's not bad, and I feel that Annette Bening and who's the guy? Jamie Bell are both. They elevate what would have otherwise been a kind of standard, more mediocre film.
Mom and Dad was a risk. He took an experiment, and it worked on all levels. I loved this movie so much. It has a lot to say in a very unique lens. Go find this movie.
And then let us know what you think of it, because I think it will have a very limited appeal. People who do find it, who are parents at a certain stage of life, will probably get a kick out of
it. They'll empathize.
It certainly goes in a very different direction from, like, what was that movie with the when they turned 40?
This is 40.
This is 40. And so if you took This is 40 and you turned it into a zombie movie, that kind of gives you a little bit of what this would be.
The final year was supposed to be something different, and it's very fascinating only because of how we view it because of current events. And yes, it's worthwhile, but man, don't drink alcohol at the same time or use heavy machinery.
Yeah, and maybe take a tissue or two just to dab the eyes when you come out.
All right, next week I promise a bigger fight, which a movie that we have primed. We're really going to lay into each other on this. So thank you for listening to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.